Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The war in Yemen has killed thousands of people and left a large portion of the population on the verge of starvation. But 2 months ago, a spark of hope was reignited among the Yemenis. The Saudi-backed coalition and the Ansarullah resistance movement announced an extension to the 2-month truce, which was agreed upon in April. But now, the same hope has transformed into fear and anxiety for the civilians as the war-ravaged country awaits two scenarios: a new cycle of war or an extended cessation of conflict. The United Nations-sponsored truce has been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war. But even though the truce lasted despite multiple violations from the Saudi side, there have been no reports of an extension. As the expiration approached, the UN ramped up its efforts to renew the agreement, which it says has resulted in improved humanitarian conditions and has led to a significant decrease in civilian casualties. The truce brought immense relief to civilians, but its true potential regarding effectiveness and longevity remain under question. One issue that persists is Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement being dissatisfied with its implementation, saying the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its obligations. Experts have also criticized the truce for failing to address the main and underlying issues behind the war.
Well, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudis, who did block shipments and engaged in a couple of skirmishes, but it was still much better than the previous state of affairs. And that currently it seems to be expiring without serious action to make it permanent, presumably mainly because, the Saudis are not willing to let go of this stranglehold they've got right now on Yemen. And they're not willing to let go of their hopes for establishing a puppet regime and getting control of this geostrategically crucial area. And the West has apparently decided to let them.
Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen with the objective of installing a Riyadh-friendly regime and crushing the Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement. But while the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its goals, the war has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing war on Yemeni people has also sparked global outrage over grim violations of human rights. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has voiced concern over the torture and ill-treatment of Yemenis by the United Arab Emirates, armed forces, state security agencies, and on-state armed groups. Earlier this year, the UN expressed concern regarding the civilian casualties in Yemen. Many rights organizations have also condemned the acts of aggression against the Yemenis, especially children and women, and denounced the continued international silence on the crimes. But the June ceasefire, especially its extension in April, raised the prospects of peace in a country that has only faced destruction and gloom over the past years.
Well, it would be nice if a habit of peace had been established so that the hot war doesn't break out again right away. But again, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudi side. And the fact that they haven't been able to extend it is a bad sign. It suggests that the Saudis are unwilling to essentially admit that they made a mistake when they entered this war, and that they can't gain control over Yemen. And that admission would require a big change in policy. And right now, they're not under enough pressure to do it. The oil prices have gone up. The Saudis are doing okay financially. They apparently are under no pressure whatsoever from the Biden administration to roll back or extend the truce or negotiate a lasting peace. So I don't see any indication, unfortunately, that the truce will continue.
Yemeni officials have, however, expressed their doubt over a third extension of the ceasefire. They say the UN has failed to bring the much-needed breathing room for civilians. Another matter which seems to be behind the Yemenis' doubt is the Saudi-led coalition refusing to fully commit to the terms of the truce, including halting its attacks. Natural gas is one of several commodities massively impacted by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The European Union receives about 40% of its natural gas from Russian pipelines, about a quarter of which flow through Ukraine. And now, in light of sanctions raised against Moscow and the months-long war, energy truly seems to be at the front and center of the conflict. Natural gas prices reached record highs in October 2021, and prices have kept climbing since hitting a new all-time high in March. Prices on the Dutch TTF hub, a European benchmark for natural gas trading, more than tripled between February 16 and March 7 before pulling back. Russia has been accused of using its natural gas as an economic and political bargaining chip. But despite all this, natural gas has continued to flow to Europe, except for a few extreme cases. An example of this would be Germany accusing Moscow of engaging in power play over energy exports. This as Germany, which imports 40% of its gas from Russia, sanctioned Moscow and is now facing record inflation in light of surging prices. Now Latvia has joined Poland, Bulgaria, Finland, Netherlands, and Denmark in being cut off from Russian gas. Gazprom says it has halted gas supplies to Riga in light of their violation of supply conditions. While Russia did not specify the violations, it had already cut off gas supplies to the other countries for refusing to pay in ruble. Riga had already decided to ban Russian gas imports from January 2023, and last week it even said it was not buying Russian gas from Gazprom. And on Saturday, Latvia said that Gazprom's decision would have little effect on the country. But while many European countries have expressed similar remarks in light of Russia's bans and rises in energy prices, their decisions seem to be going against their national interests, mainly as they have made such remarks while failing to find alternatives to cheap Russian gas. So what seems to be the case is a political decision at the expense of the people who have thus far incurred the unbearable rising costs of living.
Well, no. There is a very high-stakes game of geopolitical poker going on here, and Europe does need Russian gas. At the same time, these countries, many of them, I mean Latvia, Poland, Bulgaria, are in the forefront, Poland, in the forefront of countries that want to defeat Russia, basically. I mean, they believe they have the moral high ground, that they have a good cause, but they really want to stick it to Russia. That is their goal.
Russia is the largest exporter of natural gas globally and the second largest producer behind the US. For decades, Russian natural gas has powered European homes and industries. In 1968, Austria and the Soviet Union signed a gas deal, and in the early 70s, natural gas shipments began arriving in West Germany. But a 1981 CIA intelligence assessment of a proposed 3,000-mile-long natural gas pipeline from Siberia to Western Germany warned of a trouble ahead. It said the pipeline would be a reliable source of gas for the continent, but would also give the Soviets political leverage over Europe. Now those problems are ringing true, but only since EU and the US have sanctioned Russia, leaving Russia with no choice but to exert energy pressure on Europe. As Russia tightens its chokehold on supplies of natural gas, Europe is looking everywhere for alternatives. Coal is back on the table and deals are being struck with new partners. Despite all this, fears are growing across the continent that a Russian gas cutoff will force governments to ration fuel, risking both jobs and people's lives. Now the race to find alternatives to Russian gas has accelerated, But the question remains as to what happens if the economies tank badly, as they seem to be, and no alternatives are found. Will the EU unity against Russia fall apart?
I do not know the answer to that. Certainly, this puts great stress on European unity. In the long term, there are alternatives to Russian energy. Although Russia, you know, it's attached to Europe, it's part of the greater Eurasia region, and it is a source of not just gas and oil, but many, many other raw materials, which are now being cut off. And Europe and Russia are having a really painful divorce. And it's Europeans. Governments mean for Russia to suffer the pain, but in fact, in a form of blowback, they are suffering it too.
Indications that such unity is bound to fall apart are already emerging. Some EU leaders are already calling for a reconsideration in the bloc's strategies. Some have even labeled Europe's attempts of replacing Russian gas as being on a knife on edge. But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way, and experts say their problems may only worsen in the future.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession. The poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the U.K., France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet, the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is said to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Yeah, this one, these sales of weapons to Japan and Singapore basically came after a speech of General Milley, where he complained about the aggression, the posture of the Chinese military, especially the pilot, when they intercept any aircraft from the United States or from their ally. So they said that they wanted to give a weapon to be effective against possible interception of aircraft.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region. With major advances in missile technology, naval forces, and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries.
With the exception of four countries that are already, for historical reason, very much linked to the United States from a military point of view, it means South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. All of the other countries here are quite difficult that they can enter in a kind of alliance, a military alliance, as the NATO in Europe. There are many reasons, political reasons, but also economic reasons, because China is growing so fast and their economy, the economy of these countries, are very much interconnected with the China one.
China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
In the limelight.
In Britain, former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak has warned Conservative Party members against fantasy economics. Sunak has pledged to slash taxes by 20% by the end of the decade in a last-gasp pitch to Conservative members, with the first ballot set to drop in the leadership race. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Rishi Sunak pledges 20% tax cut by end of decade in last gasp pitch to members. Stay with us for more of Jessica Elgott's article. In Britain, former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak has warned Conservative Party members against fantasy economics. Sunak has pledged to slash taxes by 20% by the end of the decade in a last-gasp pitch to Conservative members, with the first ballot set to drop in the leadership race. But in one of his strongest attacks yet on the front-runner, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak warned party members against an act of self-sabotage that could cost the party the election, and to be wary of major spending pledges and tax cuts, which he has previously dismissed as fantasy economics. I would urge them to treat with caution any vision that doesn't involve any difficult trade-offs, and remember that if something sounds too good to be true, then it probably is, he said. Simon Clark, the chief secretary to the Treasury, who worked under Sunak, said households could not afford to wait 7 years. Simon Clark, a key ally of Liz Truss, said, Liz will cut taxes in 7 weeks, not 7 years. People are facing the biggest cost of living crisis in decades, and the tax burden is at its highest level in 70 years. The former chancellor made the pledge having faced internal criticism from backers for his narrative of restraint versus Liz Truss's tax-cutting ambitions. In the announcement on the day party members will begin receiving their ballots, Rishi Sunak said he would cut the basic rate of income tax to 16 pence by the end of the next parliament, which he said would represent the largest cut to income tax in 30 years. Liz Truss, whose campaign gained the support Sunak's replacement as Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi on Sunday night, has said she will cut taxes on day one of becoming Prime Minister. She pledged to reverse the national insurance rise pushed through by Rishi Sunak in the Treasury, as well as halting the planned corporation tax rise next year, another Sunak proposal. Sunak has said he will cut income tax by 1% from 2024, a pledge made as Chancellor, but said his number one priority is to tackle inflation and getting borrowing under control. But on Monday, he said he would go further should the Conservative win re-election in 2024 and cut income tax down to 16 pence, costing around £6 billion a year. Sunak called the pledge the biggest income tax cut since Margaret Thatcher's government and said it was a realistic promise in the current economic climate. I will never get taxes down in a way that just puts inflation up, he said, promising to always be honest about the challenges that we face. In a coded attack on Liz Truss, Sunak said the party's future in power was in peril. Winning this leadership contest without leveling with people about what lies ahead would not only be dishonest, it would be an act of self-sabotage that condemns our party to defeat at the next general election and consigns us to a long period in opposition. I would urge them to treat with caution any vision that doesn't involve any difficult trade-offs, and remember that if something sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. Sunak's campaign said the 1p cuts would be paid for by increased Treasury receipts, while projected economic growth forecasted by the Office for Budgetary Responsibility. But the United Kingdom is still projected to experience the lowest growth in the G20 apart from Russia, and have the worst growth in the G7 at around 0.5%. Truss campaign source called the pledge another U-turn following Rishi Sunak's previous pledge to cut VAT on energy bills, a policy he rejected in office. He has also made it conditional on getting economic growth first, knowing full well that his corporation tax rises are contractionary, the source said. The public and Conservative Party members can see through these flip-flops and U-turns. Sunak's campaign hit back, saying it was not a U-turn and consistent with his pledge to grip inflation, grow the economy and then cut taxes. Liz Truss spent Sunday, 31st of July, in the southwest of England with a pledge to remove further regulation on farming without giving further specifics, but promising also a short-term expansion to the seasonal workers scheme. MPs backing Rishi Sunak have privately voiced fears that he will not have time to regain public momentum before members begin voting in the coming days. Though the contest is set to run until September, the majority of members are likely to cast their ballots in the coming days immediately after they are received. MPs who have canvassed constituents say they believe the race is much closer than the public polling picture has suggested so far. Opinion polls by YouGov of Tory members put Liz Truss more than 20 percentage points ahead of her rival Rishi Sunak. But backers of Sunak pointed to an opinion poll of Tory councillors by Savanta Comres, which puts Liz Truss on 31% and Rishi Sunak on 29%. Around 32% were still undecided. One MP in a southeastern seat said the councillor polling was a much better indication of things and there was a significant amount to play for. In my constituency, Rishi is 60 to 40 ahead and they love him in home counties. That is where the huge bulk of members are. In the north, there are barely any members. One senior MP backing Sunak, who had contacted over half of their members, said they were struck by the numbers of undecideds. The Liz Truss vote is soft and quite easily persuadable, they said, saying MPs needed to do more old-fashioned one-to-one lobbying if Sunak was to have a chance. Another who had polled their members said the vote was neck and neck and very soft. The MP said, the YouGov opinion polls are normally accurate. I think Liz Truss will win, but I don't think it's all over yet. The Labour Party said the final pledges from the candidates were emblematic of a culture favouring headlines, stunts and division over practical policy plans. A Labour spokesman said, as the ballots drop, Conservative members will make their choice, but the sooner the whole country gets one, the better. Britain needs a fresh start with Labour.
Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "Perform pilgrimage to Karbala, and don't stop doing this, for Karbala has embraced the best son of the prophets."
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the lifestyle of Imam Hussein. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. I would like to send you my sincere condolences for the arrival of the month of Muharram and for the martyrdom anniversary of Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. Now today, as we're talking about the lifestyle of Al-Imam Hussein, I would like to portray a few things of how he came to stand against the oppression that was happening during his time. The Holy Imam sallallahu alayhi wasallam saw that he was the only one responsible in the view of Allah, and it was solely his responsibility to bring about a revolution. At the time, there were so many oppressions happening. The tyrant rulers had done so much bad into the society that it was so difficult for anyone else to come and correct what had happened to the life of the people at the time. Now, and if Imam Hussein wouldn't have taken any steps against the wrong being continued by the ruling tyrants, who else could do that? So hence, Imam Hussein decided to express his aims that he wanted to remove the oppressions and the mischief and revive the enjoining of good and restraining from evil so that he could lead the people to truth and justice. All these aims of the Holy Imam were mentioned in his illuminated summons that he issued to the army forces comprised of Hur and soldiers of Ibn Ziyad. Imam Hussein is reported to be saying so many speeches that were aiming at making sure that people realize that now we are living in bad times of the tyrant rulers. The tyrant rulers are destroying our society. We need to stand against this. We need to take a stand against this particular time of period when we are being oppressed. We are being, the book of Allah is being stand against, and people are not believing in the words of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam. So the work of Imam Hussein was to stand against the oppression, was to stand against the mischief that was happening at the period, and to say no to the tyrant rulers.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio, and we are talking about the lifestyle of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. How did Imam Al-Hussein get into the situation of fighting against the oppression at the time? It is said from his speech, one of his speeches, when he was saying one of his speeches to his companions, Imam Hussein said, "O people, the Messenger of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, one who sees a tyrant ruler making the unlawful of Allah as lawful and ignoring the commands of Allah and opposing the practice of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, committing before the very eyes of the people sins and transgressions, and he does not object to that, he does not object against him by words or action, it becomes incumbent on Allah to make him enter the same place that the very tyrant shall go in hell." Imam Hussein continued by saying, "All of them have obeyed the shaitan and they have become distant from the obedience of the beneficent. They have made corruption open and general. They have trespassed the limits and have took over public property in their sole control, and have made the unlawful things lawful and the lawful things unlawful. These words of Imam Hussein were expressing that people need to stand against the oppression. People need to stand against the unlawful tyrants, the bad tyrants at the time. They need to say no to them, because by keeping quiet on this, it will make you be like them. It will make you go have the same reward as they have. If they'll go to hell, we will go to hell. Imam Hussein is trying to tell his people, his companions, that you will go to hell if they will go to hell, just because you didn't say anything. You didn't stand against the unlawful acts. It's upon us, it's upon every Muslim to stand against any unlawful acts that he's seeing in his life, as the companions of Imam Hussein studied and learned from Ali Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you so much for listening. We'll meet you in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
In the limelight.
A recent report from Al Mizan Center for Human Rights shows that from January 2022 to early July, the Israeli regime navy carried out more than 225 attacks against Palestinian fishers, up from 195 during that same period in 2021. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Amjad Ayman Yaqi, writer. This article is published under the heading Brutalized at Sea, Palestinian Fishers Quit Due to Zionist Regime Attacks. Stay tuned for more. On the morning of June 16th, Majid Fakhri Baker went fishing off the coast of Beach refugee camp along with his nephew and another relative. As a member of a well-known fishing family, Majid, 38, had been in the industry for 18 years. Yet, after that June morning, he decided to quit the fishing business entirely. While they collected fish from their nets, an Israeli regime naval vessel approached Majid's small boat. The fisher said loudly, "We are fishers who just want to fish." Majid said he couldn't make out their faces. He just saw individuals in tactical gear and sunglasses. The Israeli regime naval vessel rammed Majid's boat and opened fire on the men with rubber bullets. Majid was knocked off his feet and collided with an iron pole in the middle of the boat. His nephew Nasser, 18, was hit by a rubber bullet in the left shoulder. Yet it was the other man on the boat, Muhammad, 27, who sustained the most serious injuries from rubber bullets. Muhammad was taken to Al-Shifa Hospital due to severe bleeding in the pelvic area. He is still receiving treatment for his injuries in the form of painkillers and periodic injections of antibiotics. It is just past peak season for Israeli regime violations against Palestinian fishers, according to Nezar Ayash, the chairman of the fishers syndicate in Gaza. He said that the fishing season, which runs from April to June, constitutes about 40 to 50% of the annual output of the fishing sector in Gaza, so it's no surprise that Israeli regime violations are concentrated around these months. He has observed that such violations against Palestinian fishers are systematic, timed to occur during the months when fishers could be bringing in their biggest hauls. A recent report from Al Mizan Center for Human Rights shows that from January 2022 to early July, the Israeli regime navy carried out more than 225 attacks against Palestinian fishers, up from 195 during that same period in 2021. The Zionist regime arbitrarily arrested 41 Palestinian fishers, including 7 children, and injured more than 16, including 3 children, during the first half of 2022. For Majid, this was not his first journey while fishing. On at least 5 other occasions, he has endured injuries at the hands of the Israeli regime navy. Like in 2004, when Israeli regime naval vessels shot water from a high-powered hose at his boat, and he fell and hit his head. Even on a day when fishers do not directly encounter the Israeli regime navy, there is always the anticipation of violence and danger, and precautions must be taken. Majid said, "While fishing, we often lower the lights in the evenings to protect ourselves from the Israeli regime cruisers firing. This makes it difficult to see in the dark and to pull in the nets." One time, Majid had to abandon his haul of the day when an Israeli regime vessel pulled up and, through a megaphone, demanded he leave at once. Most often, the voices through the megaphones command in Arabic a simple "go." Majid has repeatedly appealed to human rights organizations to help stop the Israeli regime violations against fishers, but these efforts have been in vain. The violations continue unabated. Because of such unchecked attacks, which continued throughout the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, some of Gaza's fishers have decided the risks of the profession are too great. Adham Sobhi, 35, is one of them. He quit fishing to work in residential construction. Sobhi's 20-member family primarily relies on fishing for income, yet the family's economic situation has deteriorated in recent years. 3 of his brothers have been laid off. And since getting married 7 years ago, Sobhi has faced a reproductive issue and doesn't have the funds for treatment. The family lives in a simple 4-room house in the Gaza City neighborhood of Sheikh Radwan. Sobhi, who has worked as a fisher since he was 15, said the Israeli regime naval blockade presents a major hindrance to Gaza's fishers, most of whom have no other career path besides fishing. Yet Sobhi chose to work in construction rather than die at the sea. "Many times I would not tell my wife about the Israeli regime violations we the fishers are subjected to, so she wouldn't worry about me," he said. Faiz Allah, 38, from Khan Yunus, also quit fishing and sold his boat. His last fishing trip was on June 25th. He was pulling his nets from the sea when a bullet hit the water. Allah was unsure whether it was live ammunition or rubber bullets, but the Israeli regime navy was opening fire at his boat and others off the coast of Khan Yunus. Allah was lucky to get out of the situation uninjured, but the horrifying sensation of near death follows him. He is currently looking for a new line of work. I have experienced the same incident before, when a bullet was shot near me, he said, adding, the same thing happened to me again in April. It was a signal that I had to quit this profession so I can stay alive for my children, he said. I don't know what the days ahead will bring, but I won't work in fishing as long as the Israeli regime occupation continues preventing us. Ayyash, the chairman of the Fisher Syndicate, said that Gaza is witnessing one of the longest naval blockades in history. Since 2015, he said, the Zionist regime has confiscated about 45 small fishing boats, or hasakets. In the past 2 months, the Israeli regime has confiscated 15 larger boats. Such confiscations may last for years, he said. But if the boats are returned, they are returned without engines and fishing equipment, essentially rendering them defunct. There are fishers who work as daily paid laborers to only get paid 20 shekels, he said. Due to Israeli regime violations, they sometimes return home without fishing or don't receive their daily wages, as the fishing profession depends on how much fish is caught. Many of those who quit fishing are currently looking for work, he said. This could mean economic ruin for the families who support themselves through fishing, such as Majid. As one of the most renowned fishing families in the Gaza Strip, Majid has lived and worked by sea for decades, operating out of the beach refugee camp west of Gaza City, where they live in an area known as Bigger Land. The sea is full of secrets and abundant, endless sustenance, Majid said. Fishing is not only a source of income for the family, but also a passion they have passed down through the generations, so all the children will have a source of livelihood. Now, as each day at sea brings more injuries and destruction due to the occupation, Gaza's fishing families have to wonder what will they bequeath to their children.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. sometimes in some places, whether they are in the judiciary, the executive branch, or elsewhere, there are some structures that naturally bring corruption. Those structures must be eliminated. Look for those structures, find them, and get rid of them. This is the second point. The third recommendation is about strengthening judicial knowledge. Judicial knowledge needs to be increased. Some of these rulings are either weak or distorted, sometimes by chance, according to a report or something. We have heard of certain rulings like this. If you look at these, some of these rulings are very weak. For example, the 10 arguments that a judge presents for making a decision. At times, most of the arguments that have been presented are flawed and weak.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Arguments must be convincing, they must be strong. Even in the prosecutor's office, not just in the court, the reasons presented by the prosecutor in an indictment must be convincing reasons, and he should be able to defend these reasons. This does not mean that whatever the prosecutor says will automatically be accepted, but his reasons must be logical and defensible. In the case of the judge and the court, this is much more important. This is what I wanted to say about the topic of having enough scientific judicial knowledge, both with regard to cases and about decrees. So, it is necessary for judicial knowledge to increase. The fourth issue is the issue of encouragement and punishment within the judiciary. We've already talked about punitive and corrective measures. They, judges, staff, should be encouraged too. You see, there truly are some, one can see this, although we are informed from far, and we know that they truly struggle, they really work in some cases, they even take their breaks to look into legal matters. Well, these examples should be identified, and such cases should be encouraged with all kinds of encouragements. When I say encouragement, this does not just mean monetary encouragement. There is encouragement for the person's reputation. There is encouragement for introducing these people and other such encouragements. These people should be encouraged, and this is the next point.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The top prize of the Islamic Human Rights Awards goes to Shirin Abu Akla. The former Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces back in May while reporting Tel Aviv's atrocities against Palestinians. Her name echoed in the seventh edition of Islamic Human Rights and Dignity Awards. Shirin was awarded for her vital role in shining a light on the Palestinian cause in her on-the-scene reports from the occupied territories.
با گلوله‌های اسرائیلی کشته شد.
Shireen was killed by an Israeli bullet. There's also criticism directed at the US. Israel is pushing the United States to avoid introducing the Tel Aviv regime as the killer of Shireen Abu Akleh. But we at Al Jazeera will continue our investigation of the case to bring her assassin to justice.
Another winner of the Islamic Human Rights Awards was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Mandla, who is now serving as a member of South Africa's National Assembly, won the award for his active role in opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
The Palestinian issue is of greatest importance to us, as we have seen the atrocities that are being meted out against defenseless children, women who are languishing in Israeli jails, as well as Palestinians in general. And we continue to expose the apartheid regime of Israel as carrying out crimes against humanity and genocide against the Palestinian people.
Organized by the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Committee, the event was held on the occasion of the 32nd anniversary of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. In 1990, member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference assembled in Cairo and laid out a new human rights charter that sought to ensure man's freedom and right to dignity in accordance with Islamic laws.
Activists here say the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights states that every human being, regardless of race and religion, has the right to a dignified life, something which they say the West has so far not lived up to.
Observers say the West, and on top of them the U.S., maintains a selective approach toward human rights, to an extent that it violates even its own principles of human rights.
For example, you see that in Canada, how they are treating the indigenous people. They are their own people, and their rights are violated. Or in the United States, so you see that how they are treating with the blacks. So they are also, again, their own people. So for them, it doesn't matter whether it is Islamic human rights or the international human rights or the Western human rights principles.
The imposition of sanctions as a punishing leverage is another example cited by participants here as a blatant violation of human rights by Washington.
The sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic are secondary sanctions imposed by the United States, not by the United Nations. South Africa itself does not observe these sanctions. We don't recognize them.
Participants say the Islamic narrative of human rights is not meant to be a counterpoint to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it seeks to safeguard the rights of Muslims against any misuse by countries such as the U.S., which looks at the issue through the lens of its political interests. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Two days after several explosions rocked the northern neighborhood of Wazir Akbar Khan in the Afghan capital Kabul, the U.S. claims the CIA successfully targeted a safe house there, killing al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. The pressure is again on people, as unfortunately, it has become very common to wake up to the sound of explosions every morning.
It was 6 o'clock in the morning when a strong explosion shocked us. We were working here and saw the smoke. I don't know the cause of the blast, but Taliban did not let anyone get close to the area.
At first, the Taliban claimed that the explosions were caused by blind rockets. Now that the drone strike has been confirmed, the Taliban condemn it and consider it a violation of Afghan sovereignty and the Doha Agreement signed between them and the U.S. They also stressed that the targeted house was empty during the raid and that there were no casualties.
As it is about sovereignty of Afghanistan, no country has the right to attack Afghanistan with manned or unmanned planes. The statements that the U.S. is making on al-Zawahiri are just claims. The U.S. does what it wants by force.
The recent airstrike in Kabul has now stoked fears among people. They are scared that such incidents might happen more and more frequently, as they witnessed 10 members of a family, including 6 children, were targeted a year ago in a drone strike before the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. The Afghan people are most shocked by what happened. They say their land has become a hotspot for settling international accounts they have nothing to do with.
but as always, they have to bear the brunt of such incidents. Abdullah